Of all the perfectly cromulent disc golf podcasts you could be listening to, you've chosen the Fish Golf Broadcast. Shove that in your ears. On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, it's going to be a win for you, me, and our guest if neither of us tells the other to go to hell. It's Matt Dollar. Dollar, what you thinking about?
Ayo, just thinking about disc golf, like always. What's up, Fish?
I don't think I've talked to you for more than like just passing by at a tournament in years now. We used to play against each other and travel together all the time when I was in Georgia. And, well, you stayed home and I moved away. And, well, now you get to bag an MP40 also.
Yes, indeed. I did visit you in Balmer a few times, though.
Yeah, just passing through for the most part. Anyway, you were known for a long time as being one of the more unique players on the tour, as well as in the local area, because of your like crazy arsenal of shots. One that really sticks with me that everybody should go watch is Charleston Classic. Is it 2012, 2013?
I believe it's 2012, the one with Macbeth.
Yeah. So like crummy weather last round, y'all got put into a short layout on... Oh, I don't remember the course, but
Trophy Lakes.
Yeah, there you go. And you're just like throwing the goofiest lines. You know, Macbeth is throwing completely rational things and you are matching him.
Yeah, you know, back in those days, a lot of times at A-tiers, you still played two rounds in one day. And that was the last day of the tournament, but we were slated to play two rounds, but it took forever because Trophy Lakes is a tough course with lots of backups and lots of water carries. And we just ran out of daylight, and so they made a pivot at the last second to play the middle short tees or something, and boy, those were just thumber central. I'd never played the layout before, but every hole was just like in the thumber wheelhouse. It was very nice.
Yeah. What a dream. It's just like playing dubs or something at goofy local course.
Yeah, I mean, you never get the chance to play against Macbeth on coverage on a course like that. So that was like a very unique experience. And I beat him for the round, and he barely beat me for the tournament, I think by like 14 or 15 or 16. I don't know. Could have been 20.
Yeah, I kept it in there. I kind of experienced the same thing. Like my strongest shot is mid-range flip up, mid-range turnover, that sort of thing. And I've started joking that it's a completely useless skill on tour because distance has been the thing that tournament directors go to, not tighter, not more specific shapes. It's like distance first and then tighten the OB.
Oh, absolutely. It wasn't a quick change either. It's been a constant just crawl towards longer and longer and longer golf for a long time. I remember when I was touring originally, it seemed like you played mostly normal disc golf courses, courses that you could go and play anytime and the course would be set up like you were going to play it in a tournament.
And like a long par three was 375.
Yeah, I mean, you know, courses would have some 400 footers, but very rarely would you have a handful of holes over 400 feet, and they're calling them par threes on a course. And I think the bigger events, it started with Worlds, where they just every year kind of geared towards longer and longer things, and there was no like really big uniform tour. I mean, there was the Super Tour originally, and then there was the National Tour, but they weren't a lot of events. It wasn't until the Disc Golf Pro Tour start. I mean, even when they started, they only had six events the first year.
Right.
But if you combine that with the National Tour, there was a bunch of events. But it's just now gotten to where it's so uniform and there's so many events that are on the tour, but yet they're all super long courses. Like, you can't compete on those courses no matter how good you are and how accurate you are. If you can't throw over 400 feet, there's no way you can compete. Unless you throw everything in from, you know, your range. 250 and in, you make everything. You're going to go be on a few holes that you can't throw far enough to carry the water. But, you know, that's the only way to compete if you don't have a big arm these days. But outside of the Disc Golf Pro Tour, you know, there's still plenty of opportunities to play for a lot of money. A lot of money in quotations here. On normal setup courses. So it does seem that A-tiers are definitely adjusting to try and maybe not match the Disc Golf Pro Tour distances, but they're definitely getting longer and longer. But there's still money to be won playing normal disc golf.
Yeah, definitely. And players have developed their skills to match what the tour is doing. You know, you get a 15-year-old kid who's seen YouTube of guys throwing bombs, that's what they want to do. So you've probably seen this happen. Like you were the dog when Isaac Robinson and Ezra Robinson and Alden Harris were coming up in Atlanta. And maybe it's good for you that they went on tour.
Oh, it's very, very, it's so good for me that they went on tour. There wasn't a big overlap of like, I was on tour. I was the only guy from Georgia really on tour. Alden started touring right before I got off tour. So like the last year, maybe 2 years, we overlapped. But as soon as the pandemic hit on and my wife and I got pregnant and then I was just off the tour, basically mid-2020, well, I mean, I guess all of 2020 because most of it got canceled. Those guys, once Disc Golf picked back up, those guys all went on tour. And so it left Georgia pretty wide open. I mean, there's still a lot of good players in Georgia, but it took that, you know, you have to shoot 1050 to win a C tier out of play. So, because that's what it was like, you know, when Isaac and Ezra were both coming into form, it didn't matter how good you shot, because they were usually just battling against each other.
go get that third place and walk away happy. I've always been impressed at the depth in Atlanta also. It's not just that there's that top-end talent. Like, for a long time, there was Vach, and then there was Dustin Perry, and then there was Cody Britton, and then I jumped in, Matt Versola, Bryson James. And now there's still, six or eight guys between 990 and 1010. Who any weekend could jump up and bite you.
Oh, absolutely. There's a ton of good players around Atlanta, and they just continue to push up.
Do you know what about the Atlanta community or tournament scene or courses is doing that?
It's, you know, that's actually a really good question, because it seems like there's never a super strong advanced field in Atlanta. It seems like guys kind of get pushed into open a little sooner. Back in my day, everyone would call you a bagger if you got, like, you know, top five in an amateur division. They immediately say move up. But these days, I don't feel like people do that, but yet these guys still seem to move up quicker than normal, I would say.
Do you think that's good or bad for them? Or for, like, the field?
You know, I think it's good for the field. And for some guys, it turns out to be really good. It pushes them to that next level. But then there's other guys who kind of find out that they don't have that next level talent, and I think it burns those guys out. So you see guys, if they move up in the open division and don't do well for over a year straight, you see those guys kind of burn out, maybe stop playing as many tournaments, because I think it's kind of frowned upon to move back a division. It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be.
Like, yeah, there's ratings guidelines for everything, so you know, you should be able to move back if your rating says that, but it's just tough to tell what guys are thinking, but I could see why you would move up, and I could see why you would want to move down.
My thought when I moved up was, if I don't play my best, I'm still winning advanced. But then there was kind of a point where I would get into open, and I would play really well, or feel like I was playing really well, and get whomped still. I guess there's kind of a happy medium where it's better if you're a developing player to learn how to win in advanced when you don't have your best stuff, or when there is somebody who's, you know, on your heels and you have to try to hold them off or chase them down.
Yeah, it seems like it's different for every person. Some people rise to the occasion, and then some people need to learn how to win. Like you were saying, I think some people, it really benefits them if they stay in their division that their rating says they should play, and they win, you know, not just one tournament and move up, but like win several tournaments, just get that feeling of winning, what it takes to win. And then when you move up, you know that there's going to be new levels that it takes you to win at that division. And I think those guys are probably less likely to get burnt out than the guys that just kind of, they win one and they jump up. And then if they don't do well, they either can't figure out what the difference is, or they just get frustrated with it. But it's a game of peaks and valleys, and a tournament style is even more peaks and valleys. So you never know, like, when you're going to come out in a tournament and stuff's going to feel off, and then you have to survive through that. And I think that happens to everyone, but not everyone is equally mentally prepared to handle it.
you also told me when I was playing the Atlanta area, doing pretty well in like the B and C tiers, that like when you get hot, you have to hit the road. Like you have to go challenge yourself. Why do you think that is? Why is that important?
Once upon a time, I remember Cam Todd, world champion. We claim him as the last Georgia world champion until Isaac Robinson reclaimed it for us. One time I asked him, like, how do you get so good? How do you get consistent? And he said, all good players through the course of a round will find the zone. It may only be for one shot, but they're going to find the zone. You throw enough shots, you're going to find like that zone that you're trying to live in. And the deal is you just have to, you have to identify that zone and step into it and live in it. He'd say that he may not feel good the first three or four holes of a tournament round or even longer maybe, but as soon as he throws that one shot that just feels everything was perfect, puts him into that zone, he said he would acknowledge it and step into that zone, and then he would be able to thrive. Like, you just have to believe. Disc golf is so mental that almost everything is just about fooling yourself into believing what you want to happen.
So if Cam's idea is the micro of get hot during a round because you found that one time, your macro is you play pretty good at home, like go play a bigger B tier, go play a bigger A tier, go find a national or a pro tour to go hit.
Yeah, I mean, like we said, the golf is going to be different, but if you get hot, you need to go. I've seen guys that have gotten hot and went on tour and boom, all of a sudden, you know, they're great. And they know they're great because, you know, they're out there proving it on the highest level. And then I've seen guys who have just found their zone for 6 months to a year at home in local action and just been, you know, it feels like they're unbeatable when you're playing against them locally. It's like, this guy can't miss. I wish he'd go on tour. And then they don't. And then eventually they fall back out of that zone. You're definitely able to ride a peak for a long time if you step into that zone. But I feel like sometimes the guys waste it and they just dip back into that valley. And then once you're back on that decline, there's just no way that you're going to say, hey, I should go on tour. It's kind of like you have your window, you got to take it. And I'm not saying that window won't come back, but it is very key to acknowledge like the zone, and you have to make the choice to step into it in a round or for a whole season. You could be playing good and you could make the decision to go on tour and things may work out differently, but you don't get that chance if you don't take it.
This is true about amateurs as well. It doesn't have to be the pro touring player or the pro local player. If you're playing MA2 and you feel like you've tapped into something, go explore that somewhere where you have to get practice rounds in or somewhere where there's a big field.
Yeah, I do believe that no matter what division you play, if you want to be a tournament player and you plan to keep playing tournaments and you want to improve, you have to travel. You can't just play your local stuff. I mean, you want to play all the local stuff you can, but if you don't travel and see other courses and, like you said, have to practice other courses and see how it is to attack those kind of things, you're really never going to see your true potential. And your round rating or your player rating is not going to be accurate. Like, you have to play courses that are out of your comfort zone and play courses that don't set up good for your game, even when you know they don't. You have to play all those kind of courses to have a true player rating and to kind of see what your skill set is and what you can do with it.
You've been doing disc golf as your full-time gig for a long time now and routinely playing 30, 40 tournaments. How do you battle through the slumps or those valleys when you cannot step into the zone?
Oh, that's a tough question. Man, it's funny when I'm playing good, I know I'm playing good and I try to play everything I can. And when I'm playing bad, I try to play everything I can to try and break out of it. Like, my whole answer to everything is, oh, I should just play more, you know, except for injuries.
Which is true. You should practice more.
You know, that practicing is very, very important. And I think that you have to do a certain amount of practice to find out what skills you have and what skills will apply, you know, across the board. But once you really, you know, have honed your game in, and then it becomes a different thing. Like, you always want to do field work from time to time and keep your skills fresh and know what you're working with. But being good at disc golf and being good at tournaments are two way different things. So, like, it for me these days, I basically never practice, but I play a tournament every weekend. So I play just enough to where, as long as I like keep my stuff sharp on the putting green at home, because like I'll throw putts in the backyard, but I'm never throwing much during the week. But I feel like I can just keep my spirits up. I can keep my confidence up. And one of the big things about that is just practice putting is so important, because you have to be confident on the green to make putts. And if you're not making putts, you lose confidence in your whole game. Because, like, no matter how good you throw, unless you're putting everything inside 12 feet, you're going to have to putt under pressure. And a lot of people, when they start playing good, they make a few par jobs in a row, and then they got a 25-footer. All of a sudden, it feels like, instead of, oh, I hope I make this, it's like, oh, I have to make this. And that is the thing that murders almost everyone in, like, competitive play, is the expectation. Josh Childs, one of the greatest competitors I've ever had the pleasure of going against, he would always say that it's just expectations that make you feel bad. Because I would always get more upset than Josh would. And Josh and I have battled so many times in little rinky-dink C tiers all the way up to, like, you know, tough A tiers. But he always said that, you know, you've just got to, I don't know. Josh is, he's one of the best players that I've ever seen at keeping his cool and just believing in his stroke and just staying confident. And he taught me a lot. And that's one of the things that really stuck with me. It's just like, confidence will pull you through. And I think a big part of that is to just know that you're going to make all your short putts. Because, like, you see people practice putting before every tournament round, and these guys are all hanging out around Circle's Edge and, like, 40 footers and whatnot. And it's like, man, I'm in there beating it up from like 18 feet. Like, if I can make a 20 footer, I can make a 25 footer. And if I can make a 25 footer, then it's fine, because, like, everything, you know, outside of that is not something that you have to make. Whereas, like, I want to make anything inside 50, but you don't have to. But if you make everything inside 25 feet, you're fine. And if you practice all your putts from 20 feet, you're going to get supreme confidence from 20 feet, and you'll make 95% of your 25 footers. Brian Schweberger told me one time that he only practiced putts from 27 feet. And sure enough, I went to the guy's house, and he's got two baskets. One of them doesn't even have a bottom. So, like, the putts don't stick. You just put them in, and they fall out. And he's like, this is another good lesson. You should have no expectations. Like, you put your thing into the basket, and then if it spits out, like, you can't do anything about that. And that was a great lesson, like, seeing him practice putting on a basket that doesn't catch anything. Because, like, oh, this guy's a genius, you know? And that's what he told me. He said, if you can make from 27 feet, you can make from 5 feet further, and then you're at Circle's Edge, and you don't have to make outside the circle if you make everything inside. I was like, dude, this guy's a genius. He'll probably go win, like, 600 tournaments.
Well, he's getting there.
he's pretty close.
How many wins do you have at this point?
I'm not sure. I'm closing in on 200 pro wins in the PDGA, though.
And that's probably close to top 10 all time, right?
Yes. Yeah, so for the MPO, PDGA wins and MPO, I'm still top 10. I think I'm still ahead of Macbeth and Dickerson. But, I mean, you know, that's because those guys are playing the hardest tournaments possible. And a lot of those top tier guys, you know, they play the tour, and then when the tour's over, they go home and they rest and relax. But even when I was on tour, it was like, the tour season's over, you come back to Georgia. Now you have, like, the winter where it's literally the best disc golf weather you have all year. And so it's like, I never stop playing tournaments.
Right. And, like, no offense, you were never the guy with the fat contract who could afford to take 4 months off.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, I mean, it kind of cost me money to go on tour, especially the last few years that I was on it, when everything got longer and the field just got so much better.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really impressive to see all these young kids coming up and being amazing. But also, like, it kind of hurt. I mean, it hurt the pocketbook more than the pride. Like, you know, you don't want to lose to these kids, but also you can just see they're the future of disc golf. And so, like, you know, it's not a big deal. Like, oh, Isaac Robinson got me this weekend. Like, whatever. He'll probably win a couple world championships, you know? But yeah, so I definitely did have to grind it out in the off season. And that's a big thing. It's like with the contracts that we had in disc golf back then, let's say before the disc golf boom.
Yeah.
I mean, salary wasn't much of a thing. I mean, there's a few guys that were getting it, but I feel like Latitude was the first ones that really stepped up and started paying the guys that were, you know, 10-10 to 10-20. And it wasn't a huge contract, but they were paying enough that guys like me could quit their job and just go do it full time. And then after that, it rolled into an MVP contract for me. And so, like, I haven't had a non-disc golf job since Latitude first signed me for, you know, a salary like 11 years ago, so, or 10 years ago.
I'm Clay Edwards, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I'm big chilling.
My name's Kyle Herbertson from Parked Media, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I edit.
You know, I spent all of season one in this very ad break saying that we would never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads. But lately, I've had a change of heart. The integrity of this show absolutely has a price. We're talking lake house money. Private island money. Lake house on a private island money. But until that hypothetical benevolent corporate overlord speaks up, though, this show is entirely supported by your support of me and my sponsors. Fish Stamp Discraft discs are available in-store and online at daddydiscgolf.com, dischub.com, and treemagnets.com, and fishdiscgolf.com when I'm not traveling. You can save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10 at checkout, unless you're a fool who likes spending full price on disc golf bags. And of course, our name is derived from Disc Golf Bra, whose media channels and website you should visit for outstanding New England content. And now, more mutual hostility between Fish and the guest.
Kind of fell in love with that. Like, I love little disc golf tournaments. I love C-tiers, I love B-tiers. One thing, when I was on tour, I really miss, like, going and getting the disc golf tournament experience. Because it's just two completely different things, playing like a pro tour event or an A tier with tee times every day where you play one round versus your normal two rounds in a day at, you know, your local tournament shotgun start.
Yeah, like you hang out in the parking lot with everybody at lunch, you see 30 people at the practice basket.
Yeah, you hang out with, like, you know, 89 of your good friends for like 9 hours. And then when it's all over and you think you should be done, you're all playing catch in the parking lot, talking about your spit outs and, like, you know, the awesome runs you had. You know, it's just, it's a magical thing. And the disc golf community really does that better than any community I've ever been a part of. And that's part of the reason why I've never left. Like, I've been through a bunch of different sports, but, like, disc golf, I'll play forever. If I don't play tournaments anymore, like, I would still play disc golf. I love disc golf so much that I could play it without winning money or any of that stuff, but I love competition more than I love disc golf. So, like, if I had something else where I was really good at competing, I might be doing that every weekend and then playing disc golf during the week. But for me, it's weird because disc golf is something so different than disc golf tournaments. And 95% of what I play now is disc golf tournaments. But, like, man, it's a lot of fun. I love going and doing this every single weekend. And I would love to play some bigger events again. I mean, I play basically every A tier within 7 hours of Atlanta now. But I would like to have a few more cracks at, like, DGPT style events. But until I can throw a little further, I'm not sure if that's a realistic goal. Because I want to win money when I play, too. Like I said, you know, the tournaments and disc golf are different things, but when you bring them together, it's just like, mwah!
So you've kind of danced around this a little bit. Can you explain a little bit more about how being good at disc golf and being good at tournaments are separate?
Pressure is just such a crazy thing. People can be so good at disc golf and know how to throw all the shots and know how to make all the putts. But if you're doing all that not in a pressure situation, and then you say, hey, you know, I shoot 12 down at my local course every time, and I see they're having a big tournament coming up there. There's $1,000 at it. I'm going to go try this out. You know, I can beat these guys. And then you go out there and you throw your drive just like you always do, and you get up there to this 22 footer, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is weird. I feel a little different. I don't know why, but something feels different. You know, and you just see that constantly. And I think for me, it was just experience. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I play so much, because I can trick myself into believing that none of it matters. And this putt's not important. This shot's not important. You see a lot of guys who can make themselves rise to the occasion by saying, this is super important. I must make this putt. But that same thing kills so many people's game.
It's a knife's edge there. Like,
yeah, you don't know which side you fall on until you try.
And it also can change throughout time.
That's like, very true.
For some people, you can get to that point, and this is the putt to win. This is the putt to tie. I have to do this. And you execute it. And then at some point, if you miss one of those, it's hard to get the confidence back in that situation.
Yeah, the next time, you miss one of those, the next time you're in that spot, are you thinking about, oh, I missed the last one, how do I do it better? Or are you thinking, I have to make this? Or can you convince yourself that it doesn't matter, I'm just going to throw a putt? That's kind of what I tried to do for a long time, was just tell myself, if I make this, or if I miss this, life goes on.
It's not a referendum on your character or your identity.
No, but if you play disc golf all the time and you compete all the time and you expect to do good and you usually do good and then you do bad, it does feel like an attack on your character.
So I guess the synthesis of this is, being good at disc golf is about like your peak skills. Being good at disc golf tournaments is doing what you have to in the moment.
Yeah, boy, that's a great way to put it, because it's all a mental battle. Once you're in that position, I think that's why experience is important, because you see how you react. And so then next time you can improve on that, unless you do like you were referencing a minute ago, where like you'd have one bad putt in a very high pressure situation. And so then next time you're thinking about that, and you can't do that. You have to just take every putt as its own thing. It is a wild thing, because you do see guys who will be so good, and then that one moment goes wrong, and then all of a sudden they can't find it again. And I think that's one of the reasons why I like to play every weekend, because if I do really bad, then there's another chance to come back and do it better.
Do you draw on your experiences in other sports to make yourself a better disc golf player?
So I played many sports, but the most recent one that I competed at a high level before disc golf was wrestling. And so I think wrestling really puts you in, you know, obviously it's a one-on-one situation. And the thing that really compares, or that works for like wrestling and disc golf, is like you were saying, you have to figure out what it is you have to do to win. You grind it out. And so with wrestling, that's kind of how it is. Like, you get in there against another guy, and then like whatever you plan to do might not work. It's like, what do you do now? And it, you know, what do I do? My main move did not work, and this guy just looked at me like, you know, I got nothing. So in disc golf is just like that. And so you have to evolve constantly, like in the moment. And honestly, I think that's one of the things that makes me love disc golf so much, disc golf competition so much, is that I can be really good in one moment and then have something go a little wrong. And it's like, okay, now I have to try and bring it back. Like, I have to evolve. I can't keep that same mindset. I have to keep working and figure out what's going to work. And I really play disc golf tournaments like that. Like, sometimes I won't throw any thumbers for a whole round. There's some tournaments where I just don't throw any thumber tee shots ever. And then there's tournaments where the first hole is like sketchy, but like a thumber would be a nice little safe play. And then next thing you know, like hole two, oh, it's a thumber hole. And then I've thrown like three thumbers in the first five holes. And then all of a sudden it's like,
you're seeing them everywhere.
I'm seeing them on every hole. And then it's like, I have a backhand that I know I can trust, But I'm also like, oh, there's OB over there. There's OB over there. I could just throw a thumber right in the middle, nice and safe. And I mean, this weekend, we're here in LA, lower Alabama, down in Mobile. And boy, I can't stop seeing thumbers. And today, it was not good for me. This was probably one of the worst thumber days I've had in memory. And I just kept trying. I just couldn't stop myself. Like, it went wrong one time and I was like, oh, I can do better. And then I didn't. And I was like, oh, no way, I'll do better. And I didn't. And then it was time for a backhand. It was like, oh, I forgot. How do these fly again? And yeah, it's just such a feel game, you know, and that evolving in the moment. And you have to be able to identify when this is an attack moment or when this is a just concede what you've already got going, you know. And today I knew it wasn't my round in the eighth year. Like, I just wasn't able to manufacture the shots like I wanted. Nothing felt good. Nothing felt right. And so it really became about not doing anything dumb and just keeping it like very simple, trying to keep in the middle and just, you know, just manage and just continue on without having to put yourself in those pressure situations. Because a lot of the times the pressure you're feeling, it's just what you've made for yourself. And if you can ignore that pressure, then you can just go right back into your zone.
Well, talking about thumbers as a gameplay strategy, I'm sure you still watch a little bit of the action on tour.
Definitely.
For the most part, players have kind of converged to the meta of have backhand, have forehand, if go left, throw backhand, if go right, throw forehand. But there are a handful of players out there who are just like booked into one throwing style. Like James Conrad is only going to throw his backhands. And Chandler Kramer is only going to throw his forehands. And then you've got your excellent outliers like Jake Wolf or his brother Ben Wolf, who they love themselves an up and over route.
Absolutely. Boy, those guys, they came out of nowhere. I run a lot of small tournaments up at Lula, North Georgia Canopy Tours. And last year, beginning of the year, or maybe 2 years ago, I was running a little C tier. We had a tiny little open field in it. And these Wolf, and these
your
Wolf
eyes
guys,
lit up.
Yeah, well, I'd never heard of these guys. I had no idea who they were. Neither one of them was rated high at the time. They both had very young PDGA numbers. And the second round of one of those C tiers, I found myself on a wooded course playing with Ben and Jake Wolf. And my mind was blown. This was right at the end. I had an elbow injury when I was on tour in 2018. And I kind of laid off of thumbers for about 2 years. And so this was really right when I was kind of bringing them back into the game. But it was the off season. It was like a February tournament. I'm really not planning on throwing thumbers. And then I meet up with these two guys on the lead card. And they're lefty tomahawk, righty tomahawk.
Yeah. Jake is righty. Ben is lefty.
Does neither one of them throw the thumber? Or no. Is it all tomahawk?
All tomahawk.
Yeah, that's wild. I know Ben throws a little more variety, but Jake tripped me out, man. He had a bag just full of discs. The guy was carrying like...
He's got 50 of them or
something.
He's
an athlete, for sure. But yeah, it was like old school Fellberg bag, where like you need two caddies to carry this thing, especially up and down the hills at Lula. But what blew my mind is the guy threw a... You know, he threw the tomahawk on almost every hole. He's got a great sidearm, too. But he would throw the tomahawk on every hole, but with a different disc on every hole. It was very impressive.
And that was not your style with a thumber. Like,
no.
You were a couple different Firebirds or like a Sidewinder, and then that gravitated into, was it Sparks, Triple X's?
When I was with Latitude, I was on the Moonshine Sparks, and then with... MVP, I like a board flat Thrill, which they don't make those anymore, but the Phase is like the same disc. They make like, it's crazy. MVP makes probably four discs that are board flat and overstable and just fly amazing for a thumber. And I can kind of just interchange them out. Like, it really doesn't matter which one, especially with between the Phase and the Thrill. I have a ton of flat ones of both. And so I just kind of like, whatever. They just do the same move. But yeah, I prefer to have one overstable thumber disc and one understable thumber disc. And I throw the overstable thumber disc on like every angle.
For distance, for weird flares. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the one I seem to throw the most these days is, it's a sidearm angle, but I'm holding a thumb or grip. The guys in North Carolina back in the day, Billy Crump told me it was called a quisenberry. Yeah, I don't know if he was just jerking my chain or what, but he swore that was a quisenberry. It's kind of like a upside down thumber, you know? And I throw that one a lot because the MVP disc just really moves left out of my hand. And so if I want to hit a gap with my main thumber disc, I just have to bring the angle down. And I lose a little distance when I bring the angle down, but like I can hit those gaps really good with that. Yeah, I'm more the get one disc working for your thumber and throw it over and over and over again. And Jake is just like, I'm going to throw the same angle on my tomahawk with 97 different discs and they will all do something different. And I know he's a sponsored player now, but my goodness, he had one of those like super soft discs when I first played with him. I don't even think they're legal anymore. You know what I'm talking about?
The Koi or something?
Yes.
I think they are illegal.
I thought they outlawed the super floppy ones or something. I don't know. We'll have to look into that. But he would even like throw a tomahawk with that or a sidearm with that, and it would like hit a tree by the basket and fold up and crumple. And it's just hilarious. Like the guy, he's definitely the best I've ever seen at having a move and then just like knowing what disc was going to do, you know, a different move for him. And that's why he would carry 50 discs.
Sure.
So I would love to see him really thrive on tour. Like he's made huge leaps in his game. And I love watching his Instagram and Facebook reels and stuff because like he goes out there and he does his little follow flight thing with the tomahawks. And it's just like, it's mind blowing the lines that he throws. I want Jake Wolf to win a pro tour event, man.
Ooh, okay.
That would be cool.
Are there other players on tour who have like a skill or a throw that kind of piques your interest in the same way?
I mean, watching Chandler Kramer at the European Open when he was on lead card, that was European Open, right?
Yeah.
Where he just threw a sidearm every time. I mean, that was beautiful. Like working all these angles on one of the most revered courses like in the world. And that was cool watching that. But yeah, like you said, almost everyone is kind of conformed. Like, there's a ton of Macbeth clones. and I mean, why not? You know, like you have the best there has ever been in disc golf, and there is a million rounds of him throwing, and there's slow-mos and follow flights and all this. Like, why not copy the best of the best? I mean, I wonder if there had been those kind of tools to access when I first started playing, if I had been, you know, if I would have been a different player. But as it was, when I first started playing, there was no YouTube videos on disc golf. Like, you search disc golf and you got that The Guardians of Disc Golf video. That was, I don't even know what it was, but it wasn't good. But that would pop up and there would be no tutorials. And then I finally remember Discraft put out a few tutorials.
They
put out, like, I don't even remember who did them, but there was like an overhand one. And
I remember there was a Jeremy Colling forehand. There was like a distance.
I honestly think this is a
pre-germ. Is this like Lizard Lawyer stuff?
No, it was straight off the Discraft channel way back in the day. But I want to say maybe even like Jeff Bennett was on one of the videos. But those were the first ones I saw where it was like showing you what to do. And it was like, I had already learned all my bad habits. I wasn't going to change them all. So, you know, I have the superior form because I developed it over time and ignorance. I mean, that's just
not knowing what's bad for you.
That's the thing about disc golf. It's such a cool game because whatever you can create out there, like you can. No one is telling you what you have to do. I mean, of course, you step up to holes that are just, you know, hallways of trees. You know, all you have is this one specific route. But they'll still, like, you'll play on a card and, like, guys won't all throw the exact same shot. I mean, sometimes they will, but you got the forehands and you got the backhands. It's just, it's cool what you can see if you watch a bunch of different players play. Honestly, like, I do kind of hate that everyone is conformed into the same stuff, but I don't know. It's fun watching guys like Aaron Gossage who can just pound the forehand and backhand. Aaron makes it look really simple because it seems like he works like a one-angle shot.
Yeah.
Maybe, I mean, I wouldn't even call it a two-angle shot because it goes to the peak and then goes that way. And, like, he has so much distance that why do you need to do anything else?
No, he can just solve it with the disc speed and its stability.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the next level here is there's all these young guys that have these pounding forehands. There are backhand-friendly holes, and then there are, well, everything's a forehand-friendly hole. Like, it just seems like you can throw a forehand on anything. Like, those guys who have, like, the incredible forehands that can, like, adjust them to all angles. Like, there's not a hole that you step up to where you're like, oh, I'm so out of position here, I have to throw the backhand. But, like, there's plenty of holes where, like, if you only have a backhand, you step up, you feel at a disadvantage because anyone with a forehand is going to make this one simple move. Like, I think the forehand is a way more valuable shot if you have that very top level of it. But the other thing is, like, how will that work out over time? Because it really hurts guys to throw those forehands super hard. Like, the elbows and shoulders, it's just not meant to do that over and over again. And if you're a full-time tour player and you're throwing those shots over and over again, your stuff's going to stop working.
Well, we've definitely seen this in baseball. There have been greater and greater incidences of shoulder capsules and Tommy John surgeries and other injuries that, like, you may or may not recover from, because baseball players are throwing with greater intensity than they ever have. You know, Warren Spahn used to throw 400 innings a year, maybe not that many, but 300 at least. And his career lasted forever, but he sure wasn't going max effort every time. That's why Jacob deGrom is made of glass. I wonder if there's something to, you know, giving yourself a little bit of a pitch count as well as not trying to rip it so hard all the time.
You know, I think it would make a lot of sense for these guys who throw a ton of forehands, those really powerful forehands on tour. I think it would make a lot of sense for those guys if they kind of find themselves out of a chance at winning in the first round of a tournament to maybe lay off those for the other rounds. I don't know if any of those guys actually do that.
I don't know.
But I feel like that if you're, I think a lot of the guys, because there's so many people that are so good and they all know that if they play their best on one weekend, they're going to win or they're going to have a really good chance. You know, there's always like the situations where if someone's going to shoot 1060 all weekend, you know, they might beat you anyway. It's all about winning right now. You know, like nobody really remembers, you know, you got top 20 a few times or whatever. It's all about winning. And so I think those guys would probably be better served for saving their weapons for those winning weekends.
I'd like to push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
We're saying, like, don't throw 20 of these at max effort during a tournament. I think that my contention would be try to throw fewer max effort in practice and throw more things, like throw slam balls, throw baseballs, throw a football. Do things that strengthen other parts of your arm, but don't do them at max effort so that, like, you're building up resilience in your muscles, your tendons, your ligaments.
I think that's a really, really good point. Yeah, I think doing that is really smart because you do get locked into doing that one move over and over and over again, and you don't strengthen other parts of your arm while you overstrengthen some parts. And that does lead to injuries, you're right.
Now, neither of us are doctors, physiologists, anything like that. This is completely amateur knowledge from one guy wearing clothes and one guy who's naked on a bed.
Yes, one old hurt guy who, I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but I can tell you which body parts hurt after every round. No, it's crazy. When I was on tour, I found myself, the courses kept getting longer, and so I found myself in a situation where I had to not throw overhands at all during the week, because once I started throwing them, you know, every practice round, if I'm throwing the overhands as hard as I can on these lines where I'm going to want to throw them as hard as I can during the round, then my arm just, like, would not last all week. And then as soon as the round's over on Sunday, I was always, like, the guy that was first to the next stop. So, like, if the round ended on Sunday afternoon, like, I am playing my practice round at the next course in the next town Monday at 6 a.m. And I think that that you do kind of have to just lay off those moves in practice. But, like, how do you get good practice for a specific course without throwing the shots you're going to throw in a tournament? And I think that's one of the things these guys have to figure out. Some of them probably handle it way better than others. And that's probably why some people seem more prepared and some people seem in better shape.
For sure. A part of a conversation I had with Zach Melton last year was how players in a certain region will develop their skills in mimicry of better players in that region. Has there ever been somebody in Atlanta who's like, oh yeah, dollars game, that's what I want to follow?
Nobody that you've ever heard of, that's for sure. No, I mean, I think I taught a lot of people overhands. A lot of people come up to me and ask, you know, stuff about thumbers and tomahawks and whatnot, locally especially.
Yeah.
And I've taught thumber, like, you know, clinics and stuff like that. And then in lessons, I've done the thumbers and stuff too. But no, not anyone that I can ever think in my entire life has come up and been like, Dollar, can you teach me how you throw that backhand shot? Like, that form is next level. I've never seen Paul McBeth throw it like that. Why doesn't McBeth do that? It works so good for you, Dollar. I'm like, oh, yeah. No, you don't want to do that. You want to follow this guy. Watch fish throw. Like,
no, don't. Nice.
Yeah, but you got a pretty smooth little shot there. But when you need to go right, you know, just copy my thumber.
Well, I can honestly say I would not have my thumber utility if I hadn't watched you shred woods courses with it. Or just, like, kind of point and shoot on open holes where you can just kind of range find.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely gave you a couple thumber lessons in some of those early battles. We had some great battles. Come on, we had some great ones. I don't know if you you guys at home know this, but I may or may not have kept Fish from winning Rookie of the Year by hitting the big putt on at Perkerson on hole 18 and then throwing in on the playoff hole. But, you know, if it's any consolation, that is the same year that I kept Ricky Wysocki from being Player of the Year because he just had to win one more B tier for the player for the PDGA Player of the Year points to pass, I think, McBeth. And so he drove down to Alabama to George Ward, an old dink and dunk course.
Average hole length 250.
Yeah, average hole length thumber. And so we had a Dollar throw thumber, and then we just putt off on every hole. But yeah, that was, you know, I've never won any big, like, Player of the Year, Rookie of the Year awards, but I did keep Fish from Rookie of the Year and Wysocki from Player of the Year in the same year.
Well, Dollar, I hope that in 2024 and beyond, your spite continues to fuel you. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find me on Instagram, whatever the fuck Twitter is, at fish58320. And if you hated this podcast, you found the guest sorely lacking. Dollar, where can people find you?
Oh, man, I mess around on Facebook and Instagram a little. $26045 is usually what I'm at, or Matt Dollar Disc Golf. So I do the YouTube every now and again, but it's been a while. I think I have some new content coming out later this year, though.
There you go. And if people want to support you, do you have tour discs and that sort of thing for sale?
Yes. Same place you have some tour discs for sale, on Disc Hub. You can find a variety of MVP, Axiom, and Streamline discs with a variety of my stamps. So feel free to purchase those. They will fly great for you, and I'll put some good karma on them.
All right, Dollar, thank you very much.
Thank you, Fish. Damn, I got really close in there for the last. Thank you, Fish. Thank you, Fish.
That's a wrap on this week's Fish Golf Broadcast. Join us next week to fritter away more of your ever-waning life force on two jabronis talking about Frisbee. Please support the show, if you're able, by shopping for fish stuff at fishdiscgolf.com, Daddy Disc Golf, Disc Hub, Tree Magnets, and Disc Golf Bras websites. You can still save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10, and please tell a friend about this show. Unless you don't have any friends, but that's your problem, not mine.